Welcome to Disruptive CEO Nation, where company founders, entrepreneurs, and cutting-edge thinkers drop in from around the globe to share startup stories, insider insights, and hard-earned success lessons. Now, here's your host, a woman who mastered business by placing heels on the ground all over the world, having worked with and coached CEOs and senior leaders from over 90 countries, and who wants you to build your best business future, Allison K. Summers.
Welcome to this episode of Disruptive CEO Nation. Very, very excited today. We're going to talk about the narrative economy and what that can mean to you and your business and the businesses that you're building. It's just my honor to have Christian Aloma as our guest. He is the founder and CEO of Threadline. Christian, what beautiful things are you and Threadline giving to the world these days?
Well, thank you. And thanks for having me on the show. The biggest sort of contribution to the world most recently has been my book, Start With the Story, which focuses on the narrative economy and branding and that sort of thing. And it's been all about my academic background in psychology and how that applies to branding and marketing in general. And so that's been a really fun adventure. And now just kind of spreading the word on that and getting folks as up to date, educated as possible around the narrative economy.
I appreciate that. And I want to share with the audience, I've had the privilege of knowing you for a couple years. I've seen you do presentations. I've actually witnessed your work firsthand. I do think that background that you have, that psychology background, and the way that you look at things from I'm going to use the word social behavior, but you can expand more for our guests. But the way that you look at things is very unique. So I'll just tell our audience that to listen for those cues, because it is a very human-centric approach, I think, to marketing and the way brands show themselves.
Yeah. You know, and I think I appreciate that. Thank you. And I think, you know, one of the things I always joke is I'm a marketer turned social scientist, right? My career has been in marketing, and I fell into and discovered psychology sort of along the way. And one of the things I realized in doing that and why it almost sort of feels so natural to me now is marketing is one of the social sciences, right? I mean, marketers are just constantly analyzing human behavior and figuring out how to influence behavior and shape behavior and design for behavior. And so whether they realize it or not, marketers are sort of part of the psychology department. And so it kind of just naturally aligns.
Yeah, I think we've had these conversations like, is marketing an art? Is it a science? What exactly is marketing? But let's talk about the book. Let's give an overview, because one of the things that if a reader picks it up, and again, it's Start With the Story, and we encourage people to go take a look, is it really is focused on relationships and the relationship of your brand to the consumer, the customer. Yeah. So can you expand on that a little bit for us?
Sure. You know, one of the things that's sort of at the heart of the book is this academic research I did when I was pursuing my PhD that was looking at the way people build relationships with brands and what those relationships mean to them. And what I discovered in doing this sort of work is people build the sorts of relationships with brands that they build with other people, right? Like we fall in love with brands, we feel attached to brands, connected to brands. Sometimes we're betrayed by brands. Sometimes we feel as in we're in unhealthy relationships with brands, right? And so, you know, and having that realization, one of the things that I noticed was that so often organizations sort of approach branding as really just almost like a courtship exercise, just a marketing exercise, just tell them some stuff that they like, make them laugh, you know, give them a discount, where the best brands that I started to sort of observe and the best brands based on the research that I was conducting are really part of people's lives, right? You know, like you don't just tattoo Harley Davidson logos on your body just because you think they make good bikes. You tattoo it on your body because you have this deep relationship with the brand. And while your brand or your organization may not get tattoos on your customers, if you are focusing on it as a relationship, you're actually sort of working with the way they want to connect with you as well, and building the sort of connection between you and them that is going to be more resilient. It's going to lead to more loyalty, and it's going to lead to more success for both parties. And that's I think really important, because we can't just look at them as wallets that we draw from. We've got to look at the value we give to them and the value that they return back to us as a result.
I think for me, the difference as I'm listening to you talk is we've all gone through the phase in marketing where it's community engagement. It's the engagement. And I think when you flip the word to relationship, there's a better, higher level aspect of listening, and connecting than just saying we're building a community. And you said something interesting to me, and that this relationship, we have a responsibility. Are we lifting people up, or are we tearing them apart? So can you expand on that?
In researching and reviewing a lot of this work, one of the things that I started to realize, and you started to see in some of the reports about branding, right, is young women's body confidence due to, the campaigns trying to sell them clothes or makeup or what have you. Boys feeling as though they do or don't fit their gender stereotype because they wanted to play with one kind of toy versus another sort of thing, right? And what I started to realize after doing that and working with brands all over the world was marketers, brand managers, businesses have probably the greatest influence on how the world feels than any other industry in the world, right? We see our doctor maybe once a year.
Wow, that is powerful that we have influence on how the world feels.
Absolutely, right? And if we realize that, for me, it's sometimes a sort of a frustration for me that you have to pass, the bar to become a lawyer, and you've got to pass the tests to become a physician, and you have to take these oaths about practicing those professions responsibly. And in marketing, we have none of that, right? We have no formal commitment of responsibility, because to me, that's a miss, because we have so much influence, far more influence than lawyers and doctors and accountants and all these sorts of things on the sort of emotional state of the world, that what we do, what we say, how we say it, how we portray our audience, how we portray our products and the relationship of our products to those audiences is absolutely critical to the way our customers feel. And if we start to care about that, right? If we start to think, rather than make this person feel scared so that they buy my security product, right? What if I make them feel more confident that their future is secured, right? That shifts the way they feel, and that shifts the relationship they have with you from being someone who isn't just there in sort of a almost manipulative kind of trap, but you're there because you care about what they care about too.
I love this. And you have a chapter in your book called Health Check Your Relationship. And so I really like what you're saying, and I hope it makes people think. You also have a section called The Core Principles of Narrative Design. Can you give us a little more insights?
Absolutely. So the field of psychology that I know best is known as narrative psychology. And narrative psychology looks at the way people make sense of the world by the stories that they tell about the world, right? All of us are constantly creating these narratives about who we are, and we're constantly revising that narrative about who we are. So if we think we're generous people, we call stories into our mind about times we were generous. And if we're creative, we remember moments when we were acting in creative ways and things like that. Now, once we understand that, we can design for our organizations to fit into our customers' stories. And that's the heart of narrative design. Narrative design is the intentional sort of a shaping of stories, of contexts, of products and services to fit into our audience's narrative, right? So that we are there to kind of make them feel like the hero of the story. We're there to help them transform from, exhausted into energized. We're there to help them transform from someone with little opportunity to someone with great potential, sort of thing, right? And so when we see that, we realize that, and we start to learn the stories of our audiences, we can then design our brands for those stories as well. And for me, it shifts from, there's that framework out there in marketing and product innovation called jobs to be done. And jobs to be done looks at what's the job they need us to do and how do we make sure we do that well, right? I propose stories to be told as a framework, right? What are the stories that they want to tell, and how can we make those stories happen as a brand, as a marketer, as a business? And that sort of is at the heart of narrative design, of figuring out what are these stories our customers are telling, and how can we enhance them? How can we make them more rewarding? How can we make them more transformative by simply being in their life?
I think this, yeah, this concept of by simply being in their life, and marrying it with what you said before, making them feel better about themselves and their life, that they are making the right decisions to engage with your brand or to buy your products or just to be in your circle of influence. I want to flip because you do dedicate, you have two different chapters in your book. One is like the consumer story, but you also talk about the nonprofit narrative. And those things are similar and are different. So can you walk us through some of those pieces? Because I also know I want to give a shout out. We're talking a lot about your book, but I want to give a shout out to Threadline and what you do at Threadline, because I also know you help nonprofits and you help, B2B and B2C businesses.
So we do, yeah. I mean, Threadline is, we sometimes call ourselves a narrative design firm. We help organizations go through that process of narrative design, from uncovering the stories that their customers are telling to helping them fit into those stories. And we do that for a broad swath of audiences. Last year, I guess, is one of the things that has happened recently. We became a B Corp. And part
Nice.
of our B Corp business model is that 20% of our time is contributed to nonprofit organizations, whether it's volunteering or it's pro bono work or what have you. And so I do think a lot. I mean, the nonprofit industry is sort of in my heart. It's in my family, right? My father is a former executive director of one of the largest nonprofits in the US. And so, I tried to sort of think about how can we help them, because, the nonprofit industry is it's an interesting one, right? Because in the consumer world, you give someone your resources and you get a product, or you get a service, or you get a thing. In the nonprofit world, you give someone your resources, you don't get anything back, at least not tangibly, right? And so when we talk to nonprofits about these brand stories and understanding what their brand story is, we typically have to push their brand story one step further, right? So they have to build out their story of, we're here to help eradicate hunger in middle school children in the US or in Illinois, things like that. But then, in order to make space for the donor to fit into that story, we tell them, you have to now threaten your story. You have to say that this story of eradicating hunger is not possible without support like yours. And what you do by threatening the story is you create a little sort of crack in the story, a gap in the story, and that gap allows the donor or the volunteer or the board member to see themselves in your story as a nonprofit, right? And once they see themselves in your story, it starts to become their story. They start to tell the world about the work that you're doing and the role that they're playing, and they start to feel really good about themselves, because it's not just a transaction anymore. Now it's part of my identity. It's part of the stories that I get to tell about myself as being a generous person, or a person who cares about kids, or mental health.
Yeah, well, my listeners know that I spent a long time in corporate, and then I took my business skills to the nonprofit space, the association space, and it is a very difficult thing because I'm not selling widgets, and it's a sense of community, but it's also a piece of making the world better based on what you believe in, and those stories are really hard to tell. Do you have any case studies that you could share with our listeners?
Absolutely. One of the ones that we've worked on many years ago, it was an organization called Food for the Poor, and they're an international aid organization. One of the things that we helped them identify was, first, what are the stories their donors were telling? And what we heard, especially that organization was a faith-based organization. So they heard, part of the reason people give is, out of an obligation to faith, a sense of faith, a sense of, to some degree, trying to sort of absolve themselves of their sins and to, sort of build a relationship with, an afterlife, with a higher power sort of thing. And what the organization saw and heard from that was, we have to make them recognize and realize that their gifts are gifts that are gifts of faith, that help them align with their faith, right? Because when Food for the Poor goes and serves the poor in the Caribbean, where they sort of work the most, they are doing, sort of biblical work, and they're doing that work on behalf of that donor overall, right? And so they wanted to figure out how to tie them to that. And so they took one of their newsletters that they send to their donors every year, one of their worst performing newsletters that they had, and they said, let's scrap this. Let's reframe this letter to something that acknowledges the donor's sort of role in our story as a nonprofit. And so they redrafted a whole new letter. They talked about, the relationship they've had with the donor, the amount that donor individually has given to the organization, the impact that those gifts have had on the community, and they spoke to sort of the kind of the reward of faith that that should provide to the donor. They did not formally ask for an appeal. They did not ask for anything in return. They just sort of sent a bit of a thank you letter, essentially, right? That letter went from probably sort of performing at about $100,000 to $200,000 in funds raised, typically previously, to raising almost 2 million without a formal appeal, right? Because what happened, what they realized they had done, is that they fully immersed and engaged the donor in the relationship with the organization, and the donors felt it, and the donors responded because the donors wanted to feel more of that. And so then they started giving and giving again, right? And it's that sort of power that, once you identify the story of your audience, and then you figure out how you fit into that or how you enhance that and how you can invite them into your story, especially as a nonprofit, then that relationship deepens in such beautiful ways. It's that sort of work that is really about, yes, funds were raised. The mission was extended, the objectives were met, but also they now have a donor that's likely to be loyal for life, right? The ones that really sort of took those messages to heart. And that's the real power of the relationship. That's the trust that was built.
So it's interesting because I'm thinking about the e-commerce world, and I'm thinking about a product that I had been watching, really wanted, and invested in. And I kind of went
Yeah.
all in and bought like a suite of what they stuffed. And we think about, like, we talk a lot about in marketing about the sticky factor, right? But I think the words you use of feel more of that, like, how
Yeah.
did this product make me feel more of that? And I opened the box. Beautiful box, beautiful packaging, colorful products, like so excited. But
Yeah.
every other communication I received after that was about trying to sell me more of this
Right.
product. And I'm thinking, you're right. I'm listening to you tell these journey stories, and I'm like, they missed the mark because they didn't write to me about how my journey was with the product, how I was interacting with the product, like, would I want to figure out how to get a friend to try the product with
Right,
me to do the
right.
journey together with somebody else. Instead, they just kept writing me, wanting me to buy more of the product. And
Yeah, and
so, yeah, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, oh yeah, I can think of brands that miss the mark all the time.
well, and that's why I do think the relationship sort of framework or the relationship metaphor is such a powerful one because, we do as marketers and as business owners so often think, well, they've made the sale. Now I need to figure out if I can make another sale or I need to move to the next sale. And we will abandon that relationship or leave them to sort of navigate the relationship on their own. And I always, when I do workshops and things like this with folks all over the world, I always say, what would it feel like if you started to build a relationship with someone who may be your significant other today? And after a month, they started to start, kind of ignoring you, or they decided to start asking if you could dress up again for them, right? And they started to sort of treat you in these ways that feel really icky, right? And I said, that relationship feels awful. You'd probably leave that relationship pretty quickly. And yet we do that to our customers every day, rather than wanting to know what they care about today, wanting to know what their emotions are, all of their emotions, right? Wanting to know what their values are, wanting to know how we can be a better relationship, how we can be a better partner to them in the future, wanting to basically sort of grow old with them. And you see the brands that really do that well, right? I mean, Diapers is an example. They really focus on building a relationship with parents from birth all the way through to sometimes, kind of the past the toddler years, right? Because if they were just to focus on the infant, the parent would outgrow them, right? I mean, the parent wouldn't have a need for them. So they wanted to focus on each of those life stages all the way through. Another one of my favorite examples from the consumer world, we used to subscribe to a company called Snackbox, and every month they would send you a box of snacks. But it was a box of snacks from a different country around the world, right? And so it would be these really, to Americans, strange snacks of, tomato flavored chips or shrimp flavored chips and, drinks that taste like rose or whatever it may be, right? Things like that.
Snacks are the best part of international travel, Christian.
Oh my gosh. Well, and that's what they sort of tapped into, right? Is because they
Yeah.
knew, like, as a family sitting at dinner, and we're a family that loves travel and we love culture and we like to sort of see the world, it isn't necessarily about finding the restaurant and the meal. The thing that most people miss on their travels in many cases are the vending machines, right? Like the flavor of Kit Kats they've and things like that. And so they really sort of found a way to like keep me and my family talking about travel and culture and appreciating the differences in different cultures. Like we would joke at the table about which of us liked the flavor of this thing and which of us thought it was absolutely awful, and how that's what our snack would be if we were living in Japan, right? And so they would just share that. They would focus on that, and they wouldn't do like what you were describing, which was, hey, do you want to buy this extra box, right? It was just, hey, how would you like to hear about this country we just sent you? And do you want to hear their music? We've got this music you could download that represents that country, things like that. So they really focused on building a relationship around travel and snacks, which is, sounds like for you, probably two of our favorite things.
Absolutely, absolutely. I want to flip and again, I want to tell everybody to go take a look at your book, Start with the Story. But you're out there in the marketing world, you're talking to businesses and brands all the time. What are some trends that you're seeing, either for good or for evil? What are some of the other marketing trends that you see out there?
I just saw one yesterday that really sort of struck me, and it was this idea. It feels as though it's a reaction to the past 5 years of everything going on, from social unrest to the pandemic to the elections and all these sorts of things, where they said, purpose is dead and creativity is king, right? And it was all about how we should stop worrying about the, we understand and we care, and start just focusing on getting people to laugh again. I don't think that's the right direction to go. And when I saw that, the sort of first reaction that I had, and I actually it was a woman named Lola Bakari, I believe is her name. I just started following her, and she's coming out with a book called Responsible Marketing that I'm really interested in. And she had posted about it, and my first reaction to seeing that article was, they didn't say purpose is dead. They said that purpose, their purpose is laughter, right? And they wanted to focus on shifting away from things like values and identity and relationships to just creating things that try to go viral, right? And it just reminded me, it sort of took me all the way back to like when sort of virality was like the king of marketing back in the day, and we're always just trying to create campaigns that were so either outrageous or hilarious that they went viral. And it's interesting because I thought we had moved past that, because we recognized that virality doesn't necessarily mean success. It just means exposure, which is certainly one metric to focus on. Whereas what we see more and more, especially with younger audiences, the audiences that are becoming the sort of power of the economy, is they care about organizations' values, right? They want you to align with their values. They want you to connect with their values. They want to know that you won't betray them as a brand, right? And that's where I think the organizations that are focusing on that, like you have from an international level, Tony's Chocolonies. I don't know if you know of their
No, I
chocolate
don't.
brand. Tony's Chocolonies is a chocolate brand whose entire mission, aside from making chocolate, and perhaps maybe just to make chocolate as a way to accomplish their mission, is to get rid of basically unfair practices in the chocolate industry, right? And they post on LinkedIn about it all day. They are constantly like sort of putting forth policy ideas to the United Nations, to the different countries that they work in. They're a brand that people love because they stand for more than chocolate, right? And that, I think, is where the power is. That's where I think the brands that are going to really thrive in the future are those that are willing, brave, and vulnerable enough to talk about things that maybe not everyone wants to talk about.
Yeah, I 100%, and I think this is just the way, you and I have children, getting ready to for college and in the workforce. Mine are a little older than yours, and the consumer brain is completely different. And as somebody who spent a lot of time at past jobs, going to a lot of events and activities at the UN, and having worked for cause-based organizations. You can only spend a dollar once, and people want to know that their dollar that they're spending is going to a business or a place that matters. And I think, to your point, that is going to just keep increasing.
Agreed.
And the visibility and authenticity in brands is so much more transparent. And it's not just the creative Instagram story that we're seeing. There's more to it. And so I appreciate what you're saying, and and hopefully we move past a world where exposure doesn't mean success.
Well, and I agree, and I think not only that, what is driving this, I mean, the capabilities of young people today, and I feel like I can call them young people now that I'm in my mid-40s, right, is so amazingly powerful. And I know organizations are also and probably constantly will be sort of more powerful than the individual in regards to the technology they have and the resources they have, but how quickly I know teenagers can find out the history of an organization, the things that is supported, the organizations it donates to. That is, information is becoming more and more accessible to the masses. And so
Well, we
they're
talk
really,
about the lens on investing. So it's not even just the consumer. It's when we talk about bigger brands or on this program, we talk a lot with founders who are building their businesses. The technology that exists today to add an investment lens, whether it's a gender investment lens, whether it's a sustainability lens, like the people controlling the dollars also have a quicker ability
Oh,
to
absolutely.
Evaluate. I mean, this is why you're seeing finally businesses add more women to boards, because the optics are there. So I think, to your point, Christian, the pressure's on both ends, right? Like you talk about the teenagers and the youth and what they can information hack, but it's also the same at the other end. The people controlling the
Absolutely.
wealth and the dollars are able to get down to it faster too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they're able to do more if they do it responsibly, right? I mean, even though we're starting to hear more and more about all of these DEI programs that are being dismantled, the brands that, again, I think consumers are going to be most loyal to, at least most consumers for the longest period of time, are going to be those who believe it's important. Because they're not being forced to do it, right? They're not being required to do it. So they are investing in it. They are diversifying their boards. They are diversifying their workforce because that diversity represents the people they serve, right? I mean, that sort of is the key to success. If you're going to build a relationship, you have to sort of be and think and feel and experience the world like the people you want to build a relationship with.
Yeah, absolutely. Christian, these episodes go fast. I want to go back and I want to compliment you for becoming a B Corp. That
Thank
is,
you.
I it's not as easy as checking a box on
It is
a
not.
form.
It is not. I know that from firsthand experience. Yeah.
Yes, my founders that have gone on that journey, there is that edge of pride that comes with that, because it is a process. Anything else that you're listening to, following, reading, watching these days that you would recommend to our listeners?
Absolutely. I mean, I've on my book list right now, from the business side of things, includes the book Sustainable Marketing, which I'm really interested in getting into. There's a couple of books that I have I personally have some early access to, but I don't have early access to all of them. One is called Heal to Lead, which is by Kelly Campbell, and it focuses on conscious leadership. And I'm really excited to sort of get into that one. And then Responsible Marketing by Lola Bakari that I mentioned, and her book, because I'm really interested in kind of what's happening around the marketing space and the business space as it comes to responsibility. On the personal side, I've been reading Tomorrow, Tomorrow, and Tomorrow, I think it's called, which has been a really lovely book to read so far, fiction, and enjoying that one too.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Christian. If people want to connect with you, learn more, where should they go and what should they do?
Yeah, the outlet I'm most active on is LinkedIn. So I think it's LinkedIn Christian A. Aloma, or just look up Christian Aloma on LinkedIn. Otherwise, threadline.co is where I live and work and play, basically. So you can find me there as well. But thank you for having me on. This has been an absolute delight. So.
Oh, thank you for coming and sharing your insights and knowledge. And I hope our listeners got something to think about. And if you did, pass along a copy of this episode to somebody else that you think needs to hear it. And as always, if you think there's a disruptive company founder that we should speak to, send me a note at connect@alisonksummers.com. Until we speak again, keep your eye on the future and always be disruptive. Christian, we really appreciate it.
Thank you, Allison. You take care.
49 faces looked to him in triumph. Over the last 12 months, they had each taken turns and promoted his business for a week at a time, driving over $987,342 in revenue. What if you had a network of 50 centers of influence who promoted your business every week for a year? Grab your copy of the number one Amazon best-selling book, The Ultimate Guide to Growing Your Business with a Podcast, at 33% off the Amazon price by going to ultimatepodcastbook.com. Again, that website for 33% off the Amazon price is ultimatepodcastbook.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.